Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have with me here in the studio Jonathan Franzen, the author of How to Be Alone, a book of essays published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He is, of course, the author of The Corrections, which has recently come out in paperback from Picador, and I thought that we would talk mostly about the essays because I think in many ways they will surprise and enhance the way people read The Corrections. Now, when I first got the book, I saw the title, How to Be Alone, and I thought, he's written a how-to book. And I wondered, was that in your mind when you submitted it, how funny it would be to have a how-to book or something that looks like a how-to book that would teach you to be alone?
Was I trying to have fun with the how-to genre? Not particularly. I was desperate for a title, and that as I was flipping through the essays, I kept seeing the word alone, and then one essay ended with the phrase, how to be alone, and there's really nothing more than that, except that I hope it's ironic. Almost everything in the book has some potential irony or ironic spin, and beyond that, no.
But it does seem as if it's a it's something of a vital, if ironic, concern. I came to the phrase in that essay that you mentioned, The Reader Exiled. Is that the title?
The Reader in Exile. Yeah.
And it ends at the first thing that reading teaches is how to be alone. But a couple of essays later, we're reading about maximum security and isolation units in correctional facilities. And I thought, well, this is a different way of being alone for sure. And my suspicion that I was reading correctly was at least abetted by your observation that some of these places seem like good places to read and write.
Yes. Here as elsewhere, I have a kind of divided sense about whether it's a really good thing or a really bad thing to be a reader. I mean, alone has that dual connotation. It's good to sort of be your own man, be your own person, and stand up as an individual in a time of increasingly mass culture. At the same time, you know, who wants to be alone?
I found it interesting that when you were doing essays that require footwork, that you're taken to places like post offices and correctional facilities, places where there's a system that's either breaking down or becoming too efficient. And that very much is part of the thematic of your first two novels.
Well, in the third as well. I mean, breakdown is at the center of that, with the dissolution of a brain, a breakdown of an old man. Yeah, initially I had conceived of this collection as a book of essays about obsolescence. I was thinking of calling it Obsolete Things, with the idea that it's possible, certainly was possible in the mid-90s, to feel that just being a reader or being a prose writer as opposed to a web page designer was an obsolete thing. And as someone who felt left behind, I had a great tenderness for other things that have been left behind, whether it's, you know, the old hard copy delivery system of the post office or that 1 million men we have, those 1 million men we have in prison across the country. That's just like, we don't need you. We're going to put you away. And there's a whiff of obsolescence hanging over a lot of these things. Yeah.
Now, there is an essay that I particularly like in the book that seems almost to be paradigmatic for what happens when you're writing. It's an essay called Scavenging, and it begins with a vast parenthesis, a vast parenthetical remark. Eventually, it's revealed that that parenthesis is from a rant that came before a decision not to be depressed, or at least a decision to try to be happy. And it seems as if many of the way these things work, that the method is to find a schism or a self-division or a paradox, a set of opposing faces. And it seems also that many of these essays, especially Scavenging, would be altered by the great success of The Corrections. Has the popularity of that book, its real embrace, changed some of the feelings expressed in these essays?
You're referring to a sense of beleaguerment, of isolation.
Of obsolescence.
Of obsolescence, of isolation. Yes and no. The success of The Corrections, which is wonderful to me, I mean, I have no objection to it, feels more like a ratification than a refutation, because, as you say, that Scavenging piece is paradigmatic in that I had already made a decision not to feel obsolescence, or to feel obsolete, but to sort of celebrate that sensation of obsolescence, to feel as if, well, this confirms my sense that there is a place for something genuinely alternative in American culture, and that, you know, the dowdy old printed word is something that's is an alternative that stays alternative, unlike alternative rock and roll or something of the kind. The longest piece in the book is an essay I wrote for Harper's. It follows very much the same pattern. Descending the steps into despair, and then kind of at least walking back halfway up the stairs to a sense of it being okay to be a writer. Specifically, the Scavenging piece ends with my attraction to dumpsters, to things found in dumpsters, and relating that, correlating that to the enterprise of writing fiction, sort of picking up what's left along the way by the sweep of American commercial and technological culture. And I still can't pass dumpsters without peering into them.
Well, what fascinated me, actually, was to discover, you end that essay by describing how a chair has been repaired that's been retrieved from the dumpster. It goes into your house. But something is happening now, and I wonder whether it will have, as it's implied by the chair, that there's something about fiction, that it can, in some sense, be saved or repaired, or easy repairs, or that those who care for it can find it in dumpsters. At any rate, I discovered that now the dumpster thing, at least in the city from which the show emanates, Los Angeles, that there are squadrons of people who are taking things from dumpsters, repairing them and putting them on eBay and selling them for vastly more than the nothing they've paid for them, and that some people are in fact making their lives the way people did in the 60s out of this kind of nothing. And it certainly is a huge surprise, because I used to kind of look at my friends who did the dumpster thing and think, you've got to stop that. We can't stop the car again. Oh, no, just leave it there. You have enough. But I'm discovering that there is a hunger for these old things. And I began to think, could that be, could it be, will it be that fiction, too, will have this resurrected rediscovery?
I'm not sure I like that analogy, because I can't imagine spending $200 on something that someone else has rescued. I mean, I would not want to buy someone else's dumpster find, and only has value to me if I found it. At the risk of sounding like one of our vain authors, I'm going to tell you the sentence that I just read that Scavenging piece in public a couple nights ago, and the sentence I paused and read slowly was something like, use and abandonment are the aquifer through which consumer objects percolate. shedding the taint of mass production and emerging as historied individuals. I think there's a sense it's hard for me to sympathize with spending a lot of money on eBay for a dumpster find, and yet I think the attraction of those things is precisely that they have some sense of history, that they resist that sensation that we all struggle with, which is that we are just we're atoms in a mass. Part of that longing to feel like there is some historical grounding for each of us in an individual story.
I'm speaking to Jonathan Franzen about his book of essays, How to Be Alone, because it struck me that in the Harper's essay, now called Why Bother, you cite someone who's done interviews with readers and writers and creative people. What is her name?
Shirley Bryce Heath.
Of course, her comments are very moving, but one of the things that she cites from readers is that they like experiencing worldviews. She says other worlds.
Mm-hmm.
As I read the essay, I began to think, no, they like worldviews, and who wouldn't, in a sense, like to be able to put on, like a costume for Halloween, the worldview of Nietzsche and follow it by the worldview of Tolstoy, opposing worldviews. You don't have to really form an identity, although your identity is shaped by the costumes you try on, but you experience what it would be like to have a complex identity. Similarly, your scavenging idea, well, you know, a person is 1 minute someone who wants a hand-cut wooden jigsaw puzzle from the 1930s with all of the figurals, and the next minute wants, you know, some pop art thing that is very campy and not of much value. It's the experiencing of different worlds and worldviews rapidly. And maybe this, a model that television gave us, is part of the resurrection of the pleasures of fiction, that we can experience the best worldviews with true fullness. You're wrinkling your nose.
Well, in full sense around, yes. Maybe. You're positing something more along the lines of a postmodern sampling, and that this is, you're just saying that it seems to me that you're suggesting that reading is a superior kind of sampling.
No, I think that what I'm trying to suggest is that after a long period of monolithic points of view and a fixed value based on money, the discovery that there's no value, that there's only the value you give to a thing, and that there are varieties of points of view very complexly expressed from an era in which centuries in which points of view meant something, as opposed to this keep your opinion to yourself period where people want to be like one another but a little bit different, and there are, you know, things to subscribe to but not very complexly, and things to distance yourself from but, you know, with an obduracy, don't bother me with it, that something is coming back. And I'm not saying that it's coming back in the form of postmodern sampling. I think it's coming back of a reminder of capacities of the human brain to be other people, to be shaken by other ideas, to be reshaped if only for the sake of an argument, and to value things because they've appeared suddenly and seem beautiful.
Maybe, although I'm not sure that ever really went away. One of the things, the best thing about the success of the corrections has been that I've been hearing from a lot of readers who I might otherwise, would not otherwise hear from. And the account I get from them is more along the lines of, I've always felt this thing, and it's rare that I find a book where or a contemporary book where I get that sense I like. I think there's kind of a fixed quantity of people who want that sort of experience. And it may be that sometimes the culture is more interested in providing it than at other times. I feel like writers and maybe artists, maybe not, of my generation are arriving at a time when we're impatient with a lot of what was offered in the 70s and 80s. Perhaps it's simplest just to say, well, you know, the world, it seemed like the world was going to change radically, and in fact it didn't. You know, it may still, but the apocalypse hasn't come yet. The revolution didn't come. It didn't come at all. None of the promised revolutions came, not the 68 revolution, and also not the sort of revolution in human consciousness that the internet provided. And where are we then? That stuff doesn't work at all. I mean, literature may not work very well, but it still works. It always did. And so coming back, yeah, although I think it's more that we on the production side may be coming back to it than something coming in or out of vogue on the reception side.
I'm speaking to Jonathan Franzen, the author of the new book of essays, How to Be Alone, from Farrah, Straus, and Giroux. He's the author of The Corrections, of course, which Picador has brought into paperback recently. And you see,
we're having a very abstract discussion.
Yes,
here,
and I want to land it for a moment, because it seems to me that when The Corrections first came out, it scared me, because the last thing I wanted was to go back into the world of family novels, and forgetting, as always, that something only takes a moment, that I was not going to see a world of family novels, or at least not after 2 years, you know, that things move along.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to go back to a world of the 19th century in which the novel teaches people how to live or brings people the news, but we're likely to rediscover novels, I would say, in the same way that people are rediscovering junk at eBay. The capitalists are rediscovering its monetary value, and the buyers are rediscovering its emotional value.
Yeah.
Both seem to be profiting in a peculiar way, and I think that's what happened with The Corrections. The publisher is profiting from the book. The readers are finding values in it that almost feel antique to them, and they thrill them to have them reinvoked. And this, oddly enough, seems to be what reading is doing at this time.
My argument, I think, is more along the lines of, I don't know if anyone else feels this way, but I do. And when someone gives me an account of the world that is not black and white, I'm grateful to that person because, well, God, the world doesn't look black and white to me. And, you know, standing on the treadmill at the gym, watching CNN, makes me feel very, very alone, because the treatments of pretty much everything is so preposterously simplistic and flashy and transient that I start feeling like, am I the only one who finds this idiotic? And books and the kind of the penumbra around books, the community of people involved with them, is where I feel at home, because you know, these are other people who feel the same way. And it's not an exaggeration to say that people who read books are the only people I really care passionately about in the world. It's not like I disapprove of or don't like people who don't care about books, but that's my family. I actually, in a strange way, probably have more of a starry-eyed 60s, 70s view of the literary production and consumption in terms of, you know, Lewis Hyde, The Gift, or something like that. I'm hopelessly confused, because I do have a commercial publisher. Last fall,
dozens of people were leaping into the Oprah Winfrey fray to say, well, he's got a problem with corporations, but his own publisher is a corporation. And it's like, well, yeah, but you know, what you don't understand is that these people feel like a family to me, and I can't help having a personal relationship with them. And even though it might not be economically in my interest to stay there, I probably will simply because I like them, because they feel like misfits in the publishing world and sort of misfits in general. And to try to sort of speak about a larger social movement based on what I understand to be a collection of misfits makes me a little uncomfortable.
That's so interesting because, you see, I come from a generation where a large group of misfits did become a social movement. Yes, we didn't accomplish anything, but we did become a social movement.
Mm-hmm.
We made a lot of people angry, but mostly in the confrontational way rather than, and in fact, in a confrontational way that turned people back to a kind of conservatism.
Right.
But nevertheless, it became a movement. What I sense is our similarity is that we both, A, love the same people,
mm-hmm.
B, want to be loved by a group of people,
mm-hmm.
and not feel like a misfit.
Mm-hmm.
So that what happened to you is, in a sense, what's been happening to this show. It began in one station, grew to 50, but I had to say at that point, no, it's not that no one wants me. It's that no one could have said they wanted me in advance.
That's a nice way to put it. Another way to put it, or a slight refinement of that, might be I still feel like a misfit. Just because people, you know, bought fairly large numbers of the corrections doesn't make me feel like less of a misfit in my daily life. It's just like it's okay to be a misfit. and that's really what I I like to think of the literary community as being one that is not so bent on conformity, where the thing is that, how to be alone refers to a sense of I'm still alone, but it's actually not a bad thing to be alone when you know that other people are feeling alone in the same way. And you can – I mean, it's paradoxical almost, but nonetheless.
Okay. But because I came here, and it's completely by accident, I've done two things that have been alone in the last day. One alone thing involved reading your book.
Right.
Another alone thing found me, and this is sort of embarrassing, but I've become fascinated by wooden jigsaw puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
And it is strange, you see, to sit in front of the computer screen, which I mostly distrust, and find myself in a bid with 11 other people,
mm-hmm.
all of whom want this thing,
mm-hmm.
for the same or different reasons. Strange as it feels to wander in the streets and have people say, I read that book you were talking about on the show. It's very good, but I didn't like the last one. And to feel, oh my God, you know, I am now in a dialogue that's only starting to have words. After the auction ends, and maybe I've had Rapture of the Deep and bid it too much, or said, oh, let them have it. You know, they deserve mm-hmm. it. They want it that badly, or they have that much money. I'm never going to succeed. They often send you an email talking about what just happened.
Mm-hmm.
So my sense, you're talking to someone who has the springtime-like sense of the beginning of a dialogue,
mm-hmm.
the beginning of a dialogue with readers, the beginning of a dialogue with other people who want the same things I want and are willing to bid on them, whatever that means.
But this is happening at a time when I have never been more worried about the direction this country is going in.
Exactly.
And I have never felt more deeply alienated, not even at the height of the Gulf War of 91. Dave Wallace and I were talking about this the other day. He said the country feels it's like leading with its chin. It's like, how hateful can we make ourselves to the rest of the world?
And at
how
the same
big a vehicle
time,
can we drive?
Its individual citizens seem to need to start a talk with one another that has nothing to do with the way in which the government is representing them or not representing them on the global scale. In other words, I seem to be finding more people wanting to talk to me about books, not because they've come to love books per se, but because they're starting to really hate the other conversation.
Right.
nonetheless, we don't seem to have the numbers to get a different government in
but
there.
But you're the one who says we don't have to have the numbers, that the book doesn't have to appeal to everyone. We have to know
absolutely.
We have the numbers
no.
to talk to.
No, I think that a sense of true individualism, a sense that one can own one's own story, a deep interest in books, propensity to look at the world in a somewhat complex way. Do I think that's going to die out? No. I don't think it'll die out until, anthrax or nuclear weapons kill us all, at which point everything will be gone. But and it may be that there's a bit of an upswing there, but it's an upswing within a rather narrowly bounded band. I still feel as if we're essentially marginal. And the kind of conversation we're having here, it's not going out to living rooms across the country. It's going out.
Nor
to
should it.
Nor should it. Exactly. No, and it's great. And it's believe me, it is really, really exciting to me when people stop me on the street and say, thanks for the book. It's like, you don't look like a person I would have guessed would have read it, and yet you just have this big smile on your face, and it's fantastic. It turns out that things are not nearly as bad as they looked. It's the equivalent of going from one station to 50 stations. I mean, I was at one station, one individual, in the mid-90s when, at the heyday of the rhetoric about, technology totally transforming our world. And now, I'm at the equivalent of 50 stations myself. And it is great. It's very, very nice. It feels like one is left behind that totally dark wood of one's 30s and has received some compensation for being that much closer to dying.
Oh, that's very I just think it's the transfer from that willed minority view to a looking around at who is with you in the minority and saying, well, it's okay, this was always going to be a minority. I mean, I may have imagined a ballpark or a stadium at one time, but that was delusional.
Or maybe a stadium, but it won't be a whole city.
Yes, right. Yeah.
I mean, it turns out the stadium might actually get filled on a good day, but only on a good day.
I've been speaking to Jonathan Franzen, The Occasion, the collection of essays, How to Be Alone. His book, his novel, third novel, The Corrections, has just come into paperback from Picador. Thank you for joining me. You can read the first essay in How to Be Alone on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.